Succession, number 20486, Reel 1.
Okay.
Wing Commander Young, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
In Blackheath.
Which year was this?
In 1915.
You were just about to tell me where you were born.
Yes. I was born, I think, 129 Shooter's Hill Road.
What did your father do for a living?
He was an army officer.
In which regiment?
He was a territorial army officer. He had been started in the Artist Rifles and moved through various territorial things to the Royal Irish. He married the Colonel's daughter of the Royal Irish, and then when the Royal Irish were divided at the beginning of World War I, he went with the horses into the Royal Army Service Corps.
Where did you go to school, in Blackheath?
Yes, at Christ College, Blackheath.
How old were you when you finished there?
I finished twice. I finished at 13, went to Dartmouth, but was only there a fortnight and was sent back with what turned out to be appendicitis and then a peritonitis. And the Navy refused to have me back on the basis that I couldn't possibly catch up with the Dartmouth term. I rejoined Christ College, and then at the age of 16 and a half, I went on the Worcester to try and get back in the Navy. I passed out top of my year on the Worcester. I passed the Royal Naval entry back to the Navy, but the Navy again refused to have me, I think on health grounds. I persisted in trying to get back in the Navy by going to sea with the Canadian Pacific on an R&R ship, but in the end I came to the conclusion that wasn't going to happen, and in 1936 I left the sea having completed my time with the R&R for a second mate's ticket, and married in Canada. But that didn't, nothing to do with the marriage, but logistically it didn't work out. And I came back to England and was offered a commission in the Royal Reserve of Air Force Officers, which I took.
Before we go any further,
yes.
What's all this you were telling me earlier about being of Chinese origin?
Oh, well, you see, there was always a family tradition that we were of Chinese origin, and I was ill with a motoring accident in 1995 in the John Ratcliffe, and they did a DNA test on me, of course, because I was in intensive care, and came to the conclusion that I had a blood group which was as rare as hen's teeth in England, which was as common as dirt in China. And
what blood group is that?
O positive. And it's as rare as, it's what's called a universal donor. And this reinforced the family tradition that we were of Chinese origin. And as I say, my understanding from my father was that originally the family, as far as he knew, came from North Somerset, and there's a great pocket of people there with Chinese names, Yang, Li, Yo, No, and so on. if you investigate it, and my friend Harry Hong has done so, certainly at the end of the Ming dynasty and the beginning of the Qing dynasty, the sailors who were at sea were forbidden to go back to China and dispersed around the world. That would be about 1360. And of course, you may say that this is far-fetched, but of course the Suez Canal was then open. Aha. You see, the Suez Canal, which is now the Sweetwater Canal, as it's called, was then open, and ships could and did sail from China into the Mediterranean. One of those, but of course, arriving in England in 1360, at the time of the Black Death, nobody queried an able-bodied man who was able to take up a position in society.
Now, you were telling me about going into the RAF, if we can pick up the story there, please.
Yes, I applied, I was sort of tentatively offered a commission in the RAFO Class A, and I pointed out to them that I was married with a little boy, and they said, well, what you'll have to do is see the Attorney General of the RAF, who turned out to be another old Worcester. And he said, well, it's quite simple. On the form where it says, where are you married, you put a blot. And when I applied to join the Air Force and had my interview, everybody, I'm sure, knew I was married with a little boy, but nobody asked me at the interview. And, of course, on the pink form I filled in, I put a blot. And when I went up to Perth to do my basic training, I took my wife and little boy with me to Burlton. And when I went from there to Montrose, the station commander and his wife knew very well that I was married with a little boy. And the station commander's wife treated my wife as the junior officer's wife on the station. other officers, young officers, were married, but in a more clandestine way. I think two others at least. I had no problems other than my wife was foolish enough to win, I think, £2.7/6 from a squadron leader's wife at a bridge afternoon, hosted by this Champion de Crepigny wife, you see. And in the morning, I was up in front of this squadron leader, Hawkins, who was my flight commander, and he said to me, "Ah, young, I understand you are married." I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Now, when you joined the Air Force, what did you say on that form that you swore was correct to the question, were you married?" I said, "Sir, well, under advice, I put a blot." And that bugger sent for that form to check. Yes, he did. And of course, he found I'd put a blot. And so nothing more was said. Poor chap was killed in Bomber Command at the beginning of the war. Never mind.
What training did you do?
I trained as a heavy bomber pilot.
Whereabouts?
Oh, I went from Montrose, where I did my basic heavy bomber training, to 10 Squadron at Dishforth.
What kind of aircraft were you training on initially?
Well, Harts and Hinds, of course, after Tiger Moss at Perth. Then, of course, passing out top of my RAFO class, I had a choice of squadrons and went to 10 Squadron on Whitley 1s.
What was it like flying the Harts and Hinds?
Oh, it was very intimidating. They were huge aeroplanes after a Tiger Moth. Well, each step up, you know, the aeroplanes get bigger and bigger. No, they were very nice aeroplanes, of course. And then I went on to Whitley 1s, which were exceedingly nice aeroplanes for their time, apart from the fact, of course, they were unstable in azimuth. And this meant that the rear gunner, of course, got airsick because the tail waggled about, you see, in flight. But the 10th Squadron was the trial squadron for the Whitley. And Stanton, who was also a St. Catherine's engineer officer.
Like yourself?
He got me to St. That's going on a little bit.
Oh, we'll come to that later then.
Yes, we come to that. Yes, Stanton was an RAF engineer officer who was a pilot and head of this trial squadron on Whitley 1s, you see. And when I finished my year's training, compulsory year's training, as an RAFO Class A officer, this was the Trenchard scheme, he said to me, well, what do you want to do? I said, well, what I'd really like to do is go up to Cambridge. And he said, done. And he said, you apply. And so I applied to all the Cambridge colleges. I got an interview at Trinity, where my father had been. But I was turned down. I went to St. Catherine's, and Portway offered me a research fellowship.
Portway was the master of St. Catherine?
No, he was not the master. He was the senior tutor then. Yes. He offered me, and I said to him, well, he said, oh, well, that's a grand title for being an adult student. You see? But it did mean that I could sit at the top table for dinner. I used to go and have, as I lived in Girton, I had to have at least one dinner in college every week, as all students did. And I used to sometimes sit at the top table, sometimes sit amongst the oi polloi.
Which year was this?
38 and 39.
But before that, you'd been with 10 Squadron.
I had been with 10 Squadron.
Whereabouts?
At Dishforth. Yes.
Did you think a war was coming at this time?
Yes.
Why?
Because my father was adjutant of the 56th London Territorial Division, and he knew very well a war was coming.
So how long did you stay at St. Catherine's for?
Just until the end of May 1939.
What use was a year at St. Catherine's for you to your Air Force career?
I thought immense use. Of course, the engineering I learnt in that first year was very valuable, and the glimpse of technical life was reinforced, if you know. My idea was that I would either, if peace prevailed, I would become an astronomical engineer. If war went, I would continue in the Air Force, which I did.
So the Air Force was quite happy about you taking a year out.
Oh, it wasn't a question of taking a year out. My commission was only on the active list for a year, and then renewable periods on the reserve after that. I was a sort of super territorial in the Air Force. There were about 300 of us taken in on what is called one of the Trenchard schemes. Every one of us had some sort of, inverted commas, military background. Transfers from the territorial army or something like that, you see.
Can you tell me about the circumstances of finishing at St. Catherine's?
Well, I just, I didn't finish. I just notified Donald Portway that I had been called back to the active list. I'd received a letter in March from the Air Force saying that they required me back on the active list on the 1st of June. And I'd written them a polite reply saying that, as they probably knew, Cambridge was still on the Gregorian calendar, and my wife very much wanted to go to the May balls, which were in fact in June, and would they be kind enough to consider a short postponement? And I got an answer which translated meant firmly no. And so I told Donald Portway, and he said to me, "Well, you're in a reserve occupation." And I said, "Well, yes, but I've given my word that I will return to the active list if I'm required, you see." And so on the 1st of June, I'd finished all my examinations, and I reported, as I was required to do, at Blackburn's Bruff. And remember, while I was up, I had tried to increase my financial means by instructing as assistant instructor at Bruff, you see. That was in the Christmas and Easter vacations. I'd taken up the beginning of my instructor's rating in the Christmas vacation, and I completed my assistant instructors while I was at Bruff. Oh, I'd also taken a B license at Marshall's in Cambridge while I was studying at Cambridge. So I was sent to Bruff to complete my instructor's rating. And when I got to Bruff, I found that, by and large, I was employed as assistant to the chief instructor, introducing candidates from the Air Force onto the Blackburn B-2 aeroplane for them to become instructors. At the end of my instructor's rating course, In July 1939, I did my check at Uphaven with a squadron leader, Smith.
Your check?
Yes, my final instructor's check. See, passing out as an Air Force flying instructor, right? And when we landed at the forced landing field, He said to me, "Young, I've got just a job for you." So I said, "Sir," and I thought, "Rhodesia, Canada." And he said, "Well, what I'm going to do is make you adjutant of 41 Squadron and the instructor." See, when you were left CFS, your posting was in the hands of CFS, right? So I said, "Well, because you see, I'd never even sat in a fighter aeroplane in my life." Never. And there I was, sent with effect from the 1st of August to be adjutant of 41 Squadron. And I spent the last fortnight of my time at Brough flying around with the connivance of the Air Force on my business as the secretary of the Cambridge University Engineering Society, arranging the lectures for the Engineering Society for 39-40. I had a very privileged, shall I say, treatment.
So you became adjutant of 41 Squadron?
Yes.
At the age of 24?
Yes.
And what rank did you have then?
Flying officer. But remember, the flight commanders were flying officers as well.
What were they equipped with, 41 Squadron?
Spitfires.
When did you first fly a Spitfire then?
Within a few days of joining them.
In August?
Yes.
39?
Yes.
Can you describe what it was like to fly a Spitfire at first?
It was intimidating. Compared with the aeroplanes I'd flown up to there, the speed was phenomenal, of course. And on my first takeoff, which was, of course, on a wooden propelled Spitfire at Catterick, I took off and very wisely went straight ahead, you see, climbing away in broken cloud. And by the time I'd got settled down, it was all brown underneath me. So I thought, well, I must be over the Pennines, which I was, much to my surprise. So I simply turned round through 180 degrees and flew back till I found a hole in the cloud, and there was Catterick underneath. But the speed was remarkable. My time with 41 Squadron was very busy and very interesting. One of the jobs I did for the CO, Fanny Adams, as he was to recover from a problem that had arisen with the new de Havilland propellers on the Spitfire. They were leaking oil all over the place, and I was, as an engineering whatever, I was told to bloody well sort this out, which I did, and stop the leaks. Other things I did, of course, was my adjutant's duties, in which I read this top secret book, AP 1300, the Fighter Command War Book, which was very useful.
What was that about?
How Fighter Command intended to fight the war. There are two copies surviving of this book in the Air Force Museum.
What did you learn from this book then?
Oh, the whole policy of the Air Ministry on how fighter squadrons were to fight the war.
Did it take you by surprise from what you found out from it?
Well, Not yes and no. one of the things that was very clearly laid down was this policy of limited response, where it was laid down that every thrust by the Germans was not to be parried, and we were to even parry serious by incursions by, at least to begin with, by a limited response, so as not to reveal our full strength. That was one of the things clearly laid down in AP 1300.
Did you agree with it?
Yes, I did.
Why?
Because my education had included Latin, and one of the things you learned was the Punic Wars and the Fabian response to Hannibal. Yes.
How did you like doing your job as adjutant?
I found it very interesting, and although I was, of course, minimally experienced, I found the men on 41 Squadron exceedingly nice to me, perhaps because they felt that I needed looking after, and I made lifelong friends in 41 Squadron. They were exceedingly nice.
But why should they not have been nice to you?
Well, I thought, oh, well, I suppose they should have been, but I just felt that having been thrust upon them, as it were, by, as a non-fighter trained person, they might have been, to a degree, exclusive. But instead of that, they were openly inclusive and nice.
Did you take to flying fighters in the end?
I did the war as a fighter pilot. Yes. I was told to be a fighter pilot, and my training as an army officer's son was to do as I was told. And I fought the war as a fighter pilot.
So you were of an obedient disposition?
I suppose I was. Or shall I say, I might have been a rebel at heart, but I knew that in order to belong, I at least had to put on a convincing facade of obedience.
You mean belonging to the squadron?
Belonging to the Air Force and so on, yes. You see, when you get in the service, you are free, really, to do what you like, provided that you do the entry requirements, as it were, and show that you can be a good junior officer. When I was a BOAC captain years later, many people used to say, oh, I didn't like being in the Air Force. I found it too restrictive. And I used to say to them, well, did you give it a go? Didn't you realize that if you, as it were, successfully overcame the entry procedure, that you were then free to become an intelligence officer, a medical officer, or what you chose. You see?
What happened to you next?
Oh, I was then posted, at the end of August, I was suddenly posted, of course, to what was theoretically my reserve position. And I spent 6 weeks down at Walmall, flying all sorts of odd aeroplanes around, training air gunners. But after 6 weeks, I was sent back to fighter command as the adjutant and instructor to 603 Squadron.
Where were they?
At Edinburgh, Turnhouse.
Did this